the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show. I'm Sean, and today I have a special guest host slash co-host slash awesome person, Feliza Cassano. Hello, Feliza.
Hi, Sean.
So do you want to let folks know who you are? Because you're new. You've not been here before. This is like a first time.
So I'm Feliza Cassano, and largely what I'm known for is editing the website Girls in Capes, which covers a lot of different kinds of entertainment. My special focus is in books, especially adult space opera.
Ah, which may explain why you are here today, given who our interview subject is. That would be none other than multiple award-winning, super awesome space opera writer, Anne Leckie. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
So this is, I think, your third time on this show?
I think so.
Yeah, because I think we interviewed you for Ancillary Justice way back in what now seems like decades ago, but it was only a few years ago. And now you're back with a brand new book called Provenance, which is set in the same universe, but is different.
Yes, it's quite different, actually.
Do you want to tell folks a little bit about the book before we kind of dive into some secret questions?
So the book, as you said, is set in the same universe as the Ancillary Trilogy, but it's not set in Raj space. And it's about a young woman who she is in very fierce competition with her brother for her very wealthy and powerful mother's esteem. And she has come up with a scheme to one-up him, possibly for good. And so she's put this elaborate scheme in motion, but almost immediately, of course, everything goes terribly wrong and continues to go terribly wrong for most of the book.
That's a good way to describe it. So the first question I actually really wanted to ask was, given that this book, it's set in the same universe, but it is not a direct sequel in a sense. I mean, it's certainly following upon events that we have seen, but it is dealing with a whole different side story, as it were. Did you find it somewhat difficult to kind of switch gears from what originally was, you know, a trilogy of novels to something that is very much separated from that?
Initially, it was a little difficult. In fact, I asked for some extra time rather than turning in a novel last year. I said, can I have 2 years to do this book? Because I anticipated having difficulty switching gears. But once I had some time and opportunity to clear my mind, it was actually a relief because I had been working on the trilogy for quite a long time, a couple of years just for the two books, the second and third books. The first book I had worked on for almost 10 years just by itself. So it was about time to work on something else finally. So I had been worried that I couldn't switch gears, but once I started, it was just really relaxing.
Well, that's always good. Feel a kind of relaxing sense of just almost relief from getting to do something different.
Yeah, it was, you know, the trilogy was a lot of fun, and in some ways I miss it, but it really was time to do something else.
So is this intended, this particular book, are you intending it to be totally standalone?
Yep, absolutely. I am intending for it to be a standalone.
Now, that's interesting. So so I guess another process question, you know, writing a set of a trilogy versus writing a complete standalone, you know, I mean, do you approach them differently? Because there's obviously larger plot considerations for, say, a trilogy, but, you know, a standalone book has a kind of different set of considerations. Do you kind of take a different process when you approach something like this?
I'm not sure the process is different exactly, because even with the trilogy, I knew where I was headed and I knew it had that big long arc, but I didn't know exactly, I hadn't outlined exactly what was going to happen. So in some ways, the process wasn't terribly different. But psychologically, even though I like to write each volume of the multi-volume thing as though a reader could read it by themselves. I didn't want any cliffhangers at the end of, you know, volume two or anything. I've still got it in the back of my mind that I need threads to go forward. Where with the standalone, I don't have to worry about any of those things. I can just say, and now the story's done, and not have to worry about planting anything I need to use way, way, way later, or where I'm ultimately headed, except the very end of the book. But I'm not sure the process itself was radically different.
I feel like Ingrid's story is very much more self-contained than each of the volumes. And this is still kind of a writing question, but her journey is a lot more self-contained than Brex in Ancillary Justice and the rest of the books. Which process do you think is more interesting for you? Maybe not more interesting, but challenging. Some people think they're about approximately the same.
That's kind of interesting. I think in some ways, well, by the time I was writing the end of the trilogy, I had already done literally years of thinking about the plot and world building. And so it didn't seem that much more challenging. But when I take into account all the time beforehand, that was a lot of work to get that whole trilogy in place and done. And maybe the difference is by the time I came to Provenance, a lot of the basic world building was in place. But since I knew that it was a smaller story to begin with, that it was only going to be one volume, I didn't feel like I had to do quite as much heavy lifting to get all of that in place.
I think the world building of the universe that you've created is probably my favorite out of any space opera.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, just I think the cultures are so well developed and they're rich and they feel like real people instead of just like, oh, this is just an American person just who's green.
Right. Or my other, and I confess to enjoying these sometimes, but like, you know, Star Trek, which is the Russians with funny ears, Chinese people with funny foreheads, you know, and yeah. Of course, I love Star Trek, so.
I actually only recently have seen Star Trek, which is kind of odd, I guess.
That is kind of unusual. So I wonder how different it must seem, because I've been watching Star Trek since I was little. And so it was almost sort of like default, like in the air, like a thing that was always what it was. But I wonder what it must look like coming to it as an adult and not already being familiar with it, and thinking like, boy, this is weird, or wow, this is really not cool, or, you know.
Well, there's definitely a lot of like, oh, this is just, you know, a Russian with pointy ears. I guess partly also, we're pretty spoiled now with how many really richly crafted universes we have available in science fiction and fantasy now.
Yeah, there's so much wonderful stuff going on. And that's, to be honest, one of the reasons I've often favored space opera is because even when it was not being done with any particular depth, that sort of world building, putting in different cultures, making, bringing in really cool things and building them up is a really big feature of space opera. And it's always been a thing I've enjoyed.
Well, I think it's interesting too, you know, because I started watching Star Trek when I was reasonably young, but I'm only 33. So this was in like, the renaissance of Star Trek, when there were like 1200 different Star Trek shows on air. And it's interesting to watch them as they progress and they sort of slowly catch up with the times in a way.
Mm-hmm.
With some exceptions, obviously. So like Janeway, for me, that she will always be my favorite captain, regardless of what anyone thinks of Voyager.
Was that your first Star Trek? Was Voyager?
It wasn't the first Star Trek I'd ever watched. It was the first Star Trek show that I watched, like, you know, went and waited for it to come on and would watch it as the episodes aired. But my grandma introduced me to I got to watch the whales in space. Like, that was my first Star Trek because of my grandma.
Oh, and that's a good one, too. Fortunately, you didn't watch any of the odd-numbered ones.
Well, not the start,
for your first exposure. Yeah, those are... Yeah, see, I'm old enough that I think I was about 6 months old when Star Trek first aired.
Oh, wow, okay. So you kind of have grown up with Star Trek in a lot of ways.
Yep.
That's awesome. You know, given that your work is very different from Star Trek, what kind of influences in space opera were you sort of drawing on when you were building this universe of yours? I mean, not just this particular book, but even the previous ones as well.
So I tend to draw on a lot of real world influences, because for my personal process, if I can envision the thing, if I can see it in my mind or hear it, then I feel like I do a better job putting it on the page. So what that often means is looking for actual objects that I can take and maybe change a little bit and put in because I've seen them. So I do like to, I like to go to museums. I like to, research, physical culture of different cultures and read anthropology, read history. But also, of course, I think, C.J. Cherry is a huge influence on my work. I think that, when I was a kid, I read huge amounts of Audrey Norton, and her sort of space opera stories have been, a really sort of basic part of my vocabulary and a basic part of the things that I enjoy about space opera. I've also, for a long time, been a big fan of Jack Vance. And Jack Vance is somebody who, well, first of all, his sentence level writing is really beautiful. And he had some, predictably, some old-fashioned ideas, some of which, you know, if we'd sat down and had a discussion, I would have disagreed with him about a number of things. But he had a knack for building cultures that were very strange, but very recognizably human. And so you'd read about this culture with these odd customs or whatever, and you'd say, that is the most bizarre thing. And I totally believe that people would do that because people are like that. He had a real knack for that. And he's a person who I've tried to learn as much as I could from on the sentence level, on describing visuals, and his knack for efficiently and quickly getting really interesting, strange cultures down on the page.
You mentioned a little bit ago that you use a lot of more real-world influences. Were there any particular sources that you turned to a lot when working on Provenance?
On Provenance, not in particular. I did try to keep in mind that I didn't want all of the food culture and the dress and materials to be what would be familiar to me and Western, because a lot of times a lot of times you'll read something where it's, you know, thousands of years in the future and people are eating burgers and fries and smoking cigarettes or whatever, and everything has the same kind of cultural load. So I did try and look around at foods that would be not necessarily Western when I was drawing on the kinds of things that people would just eat as a matter of course. But I didn't have a particular culture or set of cultures in mind that I was drawing from.
So this is kind of, maybe I'm not the only one curious about this, but their obsession with vestiges was fascinating to me. I was so fascinated by this and I thought about it way, way long after I finished reading the book, which was like a month ago. Did that come from anywhere in particular, or was that something that was more, I guess, organic from you?
So where that came from was I had decided when I was in the planning stages of this book that I wanted to write about one of my favorite space opera tropes, which is the ancient alien artifact. And in particular, the stories that involved archaeology surrounding ancient alien artifacts. And I said, that'll be cool. So I'll use that for my starting point. And I went and started to read about the history of archaeology because I've always loved archaeology since I was quite small. Thought it would be really cool to be an archaeologist. That was on my list along with astronaut for what I was going to be when I grew up. And so I said, well, now I want to read more about archaeology. And I realized that archaeology has a particular history. Like, people have been digging up old stuff since forever and saying, wow, where did this come from? Or making up stories or histories or connecting it to things in their own history since, you know, ever since there have been things to dig up. But archaeology as a discipline where governments and universities and, you know, various social associations will fund expeditions to go and dig things up. And I thought, where did that come from? And I ended up getting sidetracked into the history of museums and the history of art fraud and various controversies surrounding forgeries and such, which really ties back into the archaeology thing. And the more I thought about it, the more it seemed to me that, for instance, you go into a museum like, notoriously, the British Museum, which is full of artifacts that have been, like, hauled away from all sorts of parts of the world. But actually, I say all sorts of parts of the world, but they're only particular parts of the world. You walk in there and the first stuff you see is Egyptian and Roman and Greek. And the things they won't give back, they won't give back the Elgin marbles, which are Greek. And I say to myself, what is that about? Because that segments in with the archaeology. And the more I thought about it, the more it seemed to me that what it was about was that museums, civic museums, public museums, and archaeology as it's practiced, as Indiana Jones would say, this belongs in a museum, is about staking a claim to a particular inheritance. So the British Empire was claiming that it was the inheritor of Western civilization, and its claim to that inheritance was to say, we've inherited this from the Romans, who inherited it from the Greeks, who possibly inherited it from the Egyptians, or maybe inherited it from the Mesopotamians, who invented writing, which is also a super important thing. So you see a lot of the ancient Near Eastern stuff as well, which also ties in religiously to biblical things, right? So that becomes important. And these days now, I can't walk into a museum without saying, what claims is this museum making about who the residents of this city are? And so I ended up getting sidetracked from the archaeology into the question of physical remains and collections of physical remains, not just as art or something abstractly educational, but as explicit claims to a particular status or inheritance.
I really liked the part about the museum when Ingrid goes to visit it. And I guess she goes a couple times. But the museum, it's not often one sees museums in science fiction, but especially for her culture, it's very important to maintain those kinds of historic and heritage kinds of things. That was something that, as someone who considers myself very patriotic, I felt very affected by kind of her exploration of what her patriotism meant to her, or what was more important, whether the symbol was the most important thing, or whether what it stands for is the most important thing.
Yeah, and ultimately, well, I guess it's a spoiler to say where she ends up falling on that. But it's hard to separate those things, because whether the symbols are genuine or not, and whatever genuine means in that context, they carry so much power. They carry so much emotional power, and they carry so many associations with all of those ideas and with what it means to be a member of a group, that even if they're fake, even if they're not genuine, they're still really super powerful and really important.
Interesting. So I guess I'll bounce off this, because, you know, one of the other aspects that Ingrid kind of has to deal with, and you've sort of introduced it when you described the book, and what has been mentioned a lot in the kind of reviews of the book, is just how in-depth we get into some of the complexities of the family relationship for Ingrid, and the ways that creates all these unique conflicts. And I think this is something that goes to some much bigger things than just for Ingrid, which I can come to in a minute, because I also have questions about citizenship. But I was curious about, you know, you're designing all of these sort of very unique family dynamics that, you know, sort of create all of this tension. I mean, after all, the very first chapters are literally about the tension created by this family, because she's sort of adopted into it, but it is not really part of it. And that creates all of these problems, not least of all, given the kind of overarching plot that we're kind of dealing with and those things. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that aspect and kind of building it into the story in a way that we haven't seen in some of your other books, because, I mean, I suppose you could say Breck has a family, sort of, in a way, but it's not quite the same. It's like a different kind of family, I guess.
Sort of, yeah. Yeah, because Breck ends up with a found family, basically, which is a kind of a different thing. I mean, ultimately, it's not necessarily different. If your birth family is one that's supportive and helps you, then it's not necessarily a different thing. Ingrid's family is a family where, obviously, you know, when you're adopted as a little kid, you don't necessarily choose. And when you're adopting a little kid, you know, you don't know quite what you're getting into, just like you don't know what you're getting into when you biologically give birth to a little kid. So in that way, it isn't necessarily chosen. And families can be kind of tricky. Even when your parents mean well, they can really kind of step on you and hurt you and press all your buttons, and the same thing for your siblings. And not every parent means particularly well, and not every sibling means particularly well. But those relationships can be really complicated. And given that I had already begun to think in terms of artifacts as claims to an inheritance, that meant that I was going to focus very heavily on family, because that's sort of tied up in some of the same issues, only on a much more personal level.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, too, because that is, in some ways, a very common feature in a lot of space operas. Is, I don't know if this is quite the right way to say it, but almost this monarchical attitude, this kind of classical look at families as being structured on some of these elements, which we would often expect to see in fantasies, but which translate well enough, I suppose, to science fiction settings. And I just think that, you know, while we see that a lot in science fiction, here we get a much more in-depth look at how that would operate and the complexities that that would produce as it's interacting with some of the larger problems that are existing in this universe, which is, I think it's just it's a very interesting approach to something we have seen before, but which here is, I think, just, you get a lot more meat to it, if that makes any sense.
It does. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
You're welcome. So the other thing I want to mention, and still on the kind of world building question, which is, you know, I know in the other books we've kind of had some discussions about citizenship and what it means. Here we have this world of Tir Silas, if I'm saying that correctly.
I say Tir Silas, but my official answer, sometimes people will say to me, how do you pronounce such and such in the trilogy? And my official answer is, I say it however way. But there are a lot of, space is big, there are a lot of regional dialects and accents, so however you say it is right somewhere. And I will still say that for this book. But that's my official answer when people ask me for pronunciation.
Okay, fair. So in this particular world, citizenship can be purchased. And this becomes a part of the sort of plot going on and that we don't necessarily need to talk about.
Well, citizenship can be purchased in Tir Silas. It can't be purchased in Hui.
Right. And I think that's an interesting distinction that, you know, this creates some conflict, which I don't necessarily want to ruin, but you're kind of dealing with these different dynamics of what citizenship can mean and how they are, like, they're not necessarily invalid. Right, because there is a kind of conflict that happens very early in the book over one character's citizenship in Tir Silas, but obviously that would have a very different meaning in another place like Hui, because it's a different kind of structure. And it's not that these are, you're not like saying anything about the inherent validity of these, but rather presenting them as equally valid systems within themselves that deserve, I guess, to some degree, recognition, if that makes sense.
That does make sense, yeah.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of constructing all of these unique political structures and the ways in which they're impacting identity, broadly speaking.
To some extent, once again, I was trying not to make that sort of monoculture, especially after the sort of monoculture of the Rach, where everything was, you know, the good old space opera Galactic Empire. And it's also, I remember being really shocked when I was a kid. And of course, I went through, I feel like almost every kid I know went through an ancient Greek phase and an ancient Egyptian phase or whatever. And discovering that in ancient Greek city-states, you could only be a citizen if you had the right parents. And that there was almost no way of becoming a citizen where in the U.S., at least at the time, I'll refrain from commenting on how things are right now, the narrative was you could come from another country and go through this process and become a citizen just by, you know, desiring to hard enough and taking the test and taking the oath and everything. And that was my model for how one became a citizen of any place, because when you're a little kid, you think everything works the way you're used to. And then when I saw historically places where the only way to become a citizen was to have the right parents, or to have the emperor say that you could be a citizen, or serve in the army long enough, or various different things. And so I tried to bring some of that forward, because the places aren't going to have the same model for how you belong to a society in every single place, even places that are related, where at least it seems obvious to me that Hui and Tir Silas have actually a relationship. They are related cultures, but even on this particular thing, they have very different ideas about how one belongs to the society. And I wanted to make sure that had some kind of dimensionality to it.
Awesome, awesome. Felisa, did you want to kind of jump in with the next question?
Sure. So another aspect of identity that's explored a little more in Provenance is the way that individuals choose their own names. It's mentioned that a few different characters either have chosen a new name or are in the process of choosing an adult name. For this book, what interested you in the power of naming?
Well, that's an interesting question. That was a thing that was almost, well, like a lot of things when I work, was almost accidental. I had decided to set up a system where the cultures, the related cultures, because on Tirsilis this is the case as well, the culture recognizes three genders. They think of gender as being not binary, but trinary. And I said, okay, so I've got that situation going. So I think what I'll do is have children be considered ungendered, and then when they become adults, they declare their gender and declare their adult name. But that began, as you say, sort of a concern with, in some ways, that was as much a question of who you are. That name doesn't come out of nowhere, right? That's part of your provenance, part of where you're coming from and where you're going. And then the other character to, I don't want to spoiler it, but I know who you're referring to, has other reasons for changing your name in the process of the story. And so when I stepped into that, just as world building, it sort of snapped into place thematically, and it felt really right. And so I said, well, I'm just going to keep going with that.
I find it very interesting that names are not necessarily given as much attention in speculative fiction in general, but especially in space opera, names are not really addressed, especially when you have such a confluence of different cultures. There's not as much people mispronouncing names or being unable to pronounce names as one might think would occur naturally.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think it probably comes back to we live in a culture where we're expected to be given our name at birth, and that name remains the same unless there are extraordinary reasons to change it. And the idea that you would have someone whose name would change over the process of their life, you know, you try and go fill out a computer form or a database, and there's no allowance made for names changing. And yet names being steady throughout your life, that's not necessarily the way everybody always works. It's a question of making it more convenient for the government to keep track of you, right? So I think a lot of folks, you know, when you sit down to write, you don't question. Names are just names, right? Everybody around you has a name, and they have a certain kind of name. And so it's difficult to turn your gaze on something that's just sort of part of the air. And it takes a lot of effort to look directly at that and kind of pull it apart. And I think very possibly, and this is the prerogative of a writer, probably some number of writers may look at it and say, that's silly, I'm not going to spend all that time with names. And that's fine, they get to do that. But it's names are something that have always interested me. And yeah, I think it's a cool thing to pay attention to.
It is kind of a thing that occasionally happens in science fiction, but it's often as like a joke, where it's like, well, you know, you can't say my name because your human mouth can't handle it. Kind of thing.
Right, right. Yeah. That's where it's common. And interestingly, as you say, what we don't have is characters running up against some group whose language with which they are unfamiliar and having trouble saying it or consistently saying a name wrong. Although sometimes we'll have, oh, well, they called him Jack instead of whatever the name is because it was difficult to say or closer to what they knew. But not as much of that. So sometimes you'll have that. But you don't have the thing which you do have in real life, where there are particular classes of names that people just can't pronounce. And there are reasons for, you know, you can say really complicated Polish names, but you can't say Lakeisha or whatever. And so that's not a thing that turns up very often in fiction, partly because that, I think, requires a really elaborate kind of world building that maybe a lot of people aren't necessarily interested in doing. But I've also been intrigued at the number of folks who I'll sometimes see comment on science fiction or fantasy books and say, it was very confusing why all the made-up names when you could just use actual real names. And what they mean is names like Jill or Susan or Bob. And to me, that's almost unthinkable because all those names come out of particular languages and particular cultural backgrounds. And 10,000 years in the future, you're not going to have people named Susan, probably. You're not going to have people with all these different names. Just like I flinch, I love Swords Point, fabulous book, but I do flinch at we've got this alternate universe with a completely different history, but there's a character named Christian, and it really bugs me. Like, no, you wouldn't have that name. But for a lot of people, I think most people, and I don't blame them, don't think of names as being words with meanings, but as being just sort of in some kind of special category, names.
That's interesting. Given, like, space opera, you think we'd have more of this? Like, Feliz's question has just become this big snowball, so thank you. But, you know, you'd think you'd see more of this in space opera, because a lot of times space operas, I mean, pretty much almost all the time, we have all of these alien species, and, you know, the ones that are really going for just a lot of playful, like Jupiter Ascending, as an example, right? It's got humans, and then it's got weird zombie, immortal human, vampires, whatever, and then it's got, like, dragon-looking creatures and all of these things, and it's like, their mouths are different. They're not going to be able to speak exactly the same, so there's going to be limits. Like, there are things that, like, my mouth can't do that, like, a super dragon lizard creature's mouth can. And so there may be things I literally can't vocalize, and vice versa. And it would seem like that could be, I mean, that could create all kinds of, like, diplomatic tension where you show up and you can't say the honorific properly and you've just insulted a diplomat and you can't communicate it because, like, you've already broken down the communication. And it seems like we should be dealing with that more, because that's what would happen is you'd show up and you meet an alien species and you couldn't say the names right and you got pissed somebody off.
Yeah, and once again, that is done as a joke sometimes, right? Douglas Adams used that, where, you know, what did Arthur Dent said, oh dear, I seem to be having a difficult Thursday, and it started a war somewhere because it went through and it meant something terrible in another language. So that it turns up as jokes, but it doesn't often turn up treated very seriously, does it?
Although, funny enough, it was showed up in two separate episodes, at least, of Star Trek The Next Generation, which I've been watching. So
yes, they at Star Trek The Next Generation did try and handle some linguistic things, although some of them drove me bonkers. Darmok drives me up the wall. You can't tell stories without a language to tell stories in, so you can't refer to stories you can't tell if you can only tell stories by referring to stories. You're speaking a language. I'm sorry, I can go on and on about that. But Next Generation did try to seriously address some of those sorts of things, absolutely.
Yeah, and Voyager, I think, has a few episodes that try different kinds of linguistic problems of communication. There's a great episode, which I think most people just think is ridiculous, but they meet this alien species that gets deeply offended if you don't use the proper body language. And so to us, they look like they're intentionally avoiding eye contact and are being really rude to us. But to them, they're like following a set of very strict body language and language patterns that if you don't know how to do it and you do the wrong thing, you've basically just insulted the entire culture. You know, it's done, I think, a little ridiculously in the episode, but it is an interesting idea that there may be those kinds of things to pay attention to as well. Like Valerian, I don't know how many of you have seen that. I don't recommend it if you haven't, so you can skip it. But one of the opening scenes is where the humans are meeting all these new alien species that are going to come join the city. And, like, the default pattern is, of course, the human handshake. And that's the thing that they're all doing over and over and over. And it's sort of like, that's sort of idealistic that we could just do a handshake with everyone.
I haven't seen it, but wow, that's, why would you? No, no.
It's kind of cute, but it is kind of ridiculous as well.
Even here, a handshake wouldn't be what you would do everywhere. That's only got a particular context where that would be appropriate.
Right, and there may be situations where, like, a bow or some other kind of a nod of a head or something may be relevant. It's sort of weird that the film goes with the default human slash, I suppose the handshake is mostly a Western convention? I'm not 100% on that. It's an interesting thing, but again, it's one of those where it's like, you didn't really think this through. Like, why would the squid creature with 12 different tentacles why would they need a handshake?
Right, yeah.
They must communicate these things differently.
Yeah, but to be fair, I mean, it's hard to, when those things are just always around you, and ever since you were small, that's just how people interact. It's difficult to turn around and see that those aren't just the way that you behave. It takes a real effort to look at that and say, wait a minute, we don't shake hands because that's just naturally, universally the gesture of being friendly with someone. That's actually got a context. It's really, it takes an effort to actually see that.
That's true. Yeah. And I mean, to some extent, it could be just a thing where, you know, that's not the focus for some people. It's just sort of, we want to get past this to the other thing that is the real focus here.
Yeah, and if what you want to write is just planets blowing up and you're not worried about the rest of it, that is totally the way to go. Personally, I tend to like it when people pay attention to those things, but I mean, I'm not the only reader out there, and I'm certainly not the only writer, thank goodness.
It'd be a very lonely world.
It would.
Okay, so I guess since we're talking aliens, I feel like that'd be a good time to talk aliens in your book, because you've got a few, and we've been introduced to them before. I mean, the Presker, and I believe we've been, if I recall correctly, we've been introduced to the Gek.
They were mentioned. They were briefly mentioned, yeah.
But now we get the Gek actually kind of getting involved, and this is one of the big elements of the book, is this deal with this treaty that they're putting together, which is stopping hostilities and essentially creating a kind of narrative. And of course, the Ratch comes back into this because there's a lot of conflict among different human populations and groups that sort of resent the idea that the Ratch is sort of centralized in that treaty, or at least that from their perception. But the Gek are really fascinating. I mean, we've seen the Presker before, and they're also kind of creepy. But the Gek are, I think, they feel to me more, I don't know if this is the intent, but they felt more sinister, or felt more like you really don't want to mess with them. And I don't know if that's the intent you were kind of going for, but that was sort of the impression I got reading their interactions and how they present themselves.
That's interesting. I wanted to make them really alien, but of course it's, you make them too alien and you can't even really communicate on the page. And the character of the Gek ambassador was one who I wanted to be comprehensible to the reader, but also feel very alien. And so I guess some of that alienness, I mean, it's a little scary. You don't really know exactly what she is or really what she's capable of. And part of when she does explain what's going on, some of it just doesn't make sense, because it would only make sense if you had lived on the Gek homeworld, which, you know, it makes sense to Tick. Tick says some of the similar things. He talks about swimming down, and nobody ever explains what that is. But so, and that can be kind of intimidating and scary. But I wanted her to be alien, but also relatable and understandable.
I thought the Gek ambassador was wonderful.
Oh, thank you. She was so fun to write. I really enjoyed the scenes where she has an extended presence on stage. I really enjoyed those.
They are very enjoyable to read.
Yeah, I mean, they are a different kind of enjoyable than when you sort of introduced the Presker, who I honestly felt to me like a horror character because of the way they talked. The Presker really creeped me out in the final book of the original trilogy. So, but I mean, this is kind of a different, I guess that's maybe my kind of weird human interpretation of seeing a little bit more of a sinisterness there, but maybe it's also that I'm human and I'm misinterpreting an alien species.
It's possible. And her behavior actually, however she meant it, ultimately was really harmful and disturbing, just all around. And here she is with a lot of power and nobody feels like they can do anything to stop her, right?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the interesting dynamics is, it, I mean, right from, I think, like chapter two, you lay out very clearly, like a lot of humans are like, we don't want to mess with this treaty. Like, even the perception that we might be insulting the Gek in some way, we can't even risk that, because what we get if we don't have this treaty is destruction, because we can't really fight back. They're just too powerful.
Right. Well, and also the Gek in particular, it would be one thing if everybody was used to dealing with the Gek and knew how to avoid offending and knew what they needed or wanted and at least had some idea of how to deal with them. But the Gek never leave their homeworld, so nobody knows anything about the Gek. So it would be super easy to accidentally offend them. And so that just adds a whole different layer to it. If everybody was used to seeing them, they'd go, oh, well, just don't do such and such and it'll be okay.
I really liked the Gek ambassador. I also really liked Ingrid's relationship with her brother, which is totally veering off into Elaine going the opposite direction. But I loved their relationship.
Thank you. I'm glad. I was trying to capture that. You know, sometimes one has a difficult relationship with a sibling, and you have that thing where you're maybe at each other's throats a lot, but then there'll be that moment where you're working together, and then that'll be gone, and you never know quite which moment you're in at any given time. Sometimes siblings get along great and sometimes siblings don't.
I thought it kind of matched very well with a lot of the other things that were happening in the book, especially between Tyr and Hwei, which are kind of siblings, but they also kind of aren't.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I hadn't thought about that. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way at all.
Well, and then there's the other world, which is Bayet, if I'm getting that right.
Bayet. I say Bayet, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, we get back to the you can say it however you want. So, which is also, I guess, you could, if we're thinking of it in the way Feliz is saying, that you could treat it as sort of the like black sheep of the family in a weird way, because it's sort of off on the side and separated in a way.
Yes, and well, and also, because I hadn't looked at it this way, but if we're going to put the frame on it, their separation from the Tuim is almost sort of splitting away from parents, although they wouldn't see it as parents because that was a very sort of a relationship of conquest. But that could be viewed as a familial relationship where they say, nope, we want out of this family because it's not good for us. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but now looking at it through that lens, that's kind of different.
Kind of like the third sibling.
Kind of like the third sibling, yeah, who noped out of the family before the plot even started, yeah.
I like that description, just noped out of the family. That's great. Well, okay, so, Feliz, I think we're getting pretty close to the end because we're at about 46, 45 minutes of recording. Do you have any last questions you want to ask?
I loved the fact that the really awful-sounding prison planet is called Compassionate Removal. Please discuss your methodology.
That was actually very late in the process. I had called the prison planet something else completely different. But I knew it was a wrong name. I had called it Shadow, and that wasn't right, but it would do for the purposes of the book. But then when I sent the manuscript to my editor and I said, I'm not sure about the title, Provenance had been the working title, and I wasn't sure that it was going to work as a title. And he kept trying to come up with titles that had Shadow in them. And I'm like, no, it's not that important in the book. And then I realized what was happening was it was a wrong name, and it was a name that was... It had so many associations, it was warping things out of shape. And I said, I have to come up with a different name. So I spent several days thinking about, actually, what kind of name would this culture have given this? And then I decided, of course, they're going to have given it a really euphemistic name, something that sounds nice. And then it took me a while of walking back and forth trying to figure out what that would be. So that wasn't baked in, but I was really happy that I ended up changing it from what was really not a great name to start with.
Well, you do actually have a great moment in the book where Ingray has to explain what compassionate removal is to somebody who doesn't understand it. And it's sort of like the way you'd explain it to somebody else, like on our world, like what is compassionate removal? And people would be like, wait, but that's not very compassionate, is it?
No, huh? That was fun where you know, Tick says, so it's a prison. And she's like, no, it's not a prison. It's a place.
Right. It's this lovely, like, linguistic trickery. It's a lot of equivocations because it is a prison, but it's not a prison, but it is.
Right.
And it's just a lot of this, like, ways of manipulating in your mind, changing the meanings of words so that they don't apply, which just gets right down to the titling, right? Because if you're calling it compassionate removal, right, it does sound nice. It sounds like you're a danger to society, so we're compassionately removing you from it.
Where you can live your life and be all right and things will just be better for everyone, right? Yeah. Yeah. And I was glad that I thought more closely about that name before the book went out, because that name was, that's a really important feature of that culture, I think.
And I think it is a really good choice because it has a sense of reality to it, because we would do the same thing in our world for sure.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I mean, we probably already do.
Ours are called correctional facilities.
Correctional facilities, that's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, but not sure they correct much, but... Well, all right, so Provenance is out, certainly by the time of this recording, and if people are, like, able to hear this episode, like, somehow in their brains as we're recording it, they should go buy the book now, or else. But where folks can find the book and where they can find you, Anne, that's a very important question. So where can they find the book and where can they find you?
So the book should be available wherever fine books are sold, as they say, starting Tuesday. It's not officially out yet, although I think some bookstores have been putting it out. So pretty much any place, your local indie bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, wherever it is you get your books, they ought to have it. Or if they don't, they can order it in. I'm going to be actually traveling around for the next 2 weeks, and I don't know when this podcast is going to go up, but if you go to my website, which is annlecky.com, There's a post on the blog with my tour schedule, so I'll be in a bunch of different places. I'll be in Seattle, I'll be in San Diego, I'll be in Santa Cruz, I'll be in San Francisco, I'll be in Denver, I'll be in Austin, Lexington, Kentucky. I can get them all listed now by memory, I think. Minneapolis, Madison, Boston, and New York. So I'm going a lot of different places over the next 2 weeks. So if you're in one of those places and I'm there, please, by all means, come on by.
Oh, excellent. And then I guess the last question, which is an important one. Obviously, this book is, I mean, you just said Tuesday, so we're recording on a Sunday. So it's literally about to pop out.
It is.
But what are you working on next? Like, what should we expect from you in, you know, the next 6 months?
Oh, I've been instructed not to talk about that.
Oh, okay. So secret project for the government is what you're telling me.
It's not that exciting. I don't think it's that exciting, but I need to, like, not say what it is. But it's not that. I'm working on another book. I'll say that.
I think you are okay to say that. I think. Yeah. If not, you can tell us via email and have your lawyers send a cease and desist, and we'll definitely take care of this. All right. Well, so thank you so much, Anne, for coming on and talking to us again. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
I'm glad it was a lot of fun because the book was a ton of fun.
I am glad to hear that. I hope everybody enjoys it.
Well, if not, I mean, they're allowed to have their own opinion, but I strongly disagree, so I'm sure Feliza also disagrees, right?
Well, people can decide whatever they want about the book after I've forced it into their hands, so.
Oh, that's great. Well, and also a very big thank you to Feliza for joining me to come, you know, do this interview. This has been a long process working it into reality, but it's fantastic to have you.
Oh, thank you. It was very lovely to be back.
And you do have a website, and I know you kind of mentioned it at the start, but do you want to let folks know where they can find you?
You can find us online at girlsandcapes.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at girlsandcapes.
Awesome. Perfect. Well, thanks everybody for listening, and go buy Anne's book, Pretty Please, with a cherry on top. And on that note, awkward ending and scene. Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Cronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.